Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We move on. I'm delighted now to be joined by, I think it's fair to say, a rock and roll legend, Coyta Reardon. You're very welcome.
Hi, Brendan. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
It's an honour to be on the same show as Dr. Mate. I love him. It was great listening to him on the way in.
Yeah, he's cool, isn't he? Coyta, you've picked some music for us today.
Yeah.
And songs that have meant something to you throughout your life. What was the music in your house when you were a kid?
It was rock and roll and country and a kind of weird side dish of a Scottish entertainment from my mother. There was a fella called, I think, Andy Stewart, who had like comedy hits about Donald, Where's Your Trousers? That stuff. And she loved that stuff. So it was a weird mix of like really, really cool Johnny Cash and Elvis and Donald, Where's Your Trousers?
Was your dad the first teddy boy in Dublin?
Now, here, he'd love to hear you say that because he said he was. And who knows? I'd love to know if he was. He might have been. He certainly had the look. He had the quiff and he was born on the same day as Johnny Cash.
Okay.
So he was well into the old having that kind of cool 50s style.
And was he very, he'd moved to London from Clare. Was he very Irish-like? Was he wistful about the old country?
Not remotely. Oh, really? He was, you hate to say your dad's a bitter old man, but he was a bit bitter about Ireland. And I'd say, Dr. Mate would say, well, what was the trauma? What happened? And there was a lot of car crashes and TB in the family. And he had to leave home when he was young and he went to Dublin to apprentice as an electrician. And then he couldn't get a gig. He said him and his mates, they kind of graduated. Merrion Square, apparently, was the electrician school.
Really, yeah.
And they just had to kind of go straight from apprenticeship to go and stand on the North Wall and get on a boat. And he went to Bootle on Merseyside before he ended up in London. So he you know, Ireland didn't look after its children back then.
Yeah. So your first choice is Elvis. So this is from your dad, obviously.
Yeah, he loved Elvis and we loved Elvis. And Elvis was everywhere. He was on telly. He was in the magazines and the papers. And, you know, there was, looking back now, I remember kind of the fat Elvis jokes and the fat kind of the amazing karate suits Elvis and the sweaty Elvis, but there was also beautiful young Elvis in all the movies that just seemed to be on rotation. I feel like I saw every single Elvis Presley movie that there was before I ever left home.
Okay, that's an education.
Yeah.
So why Jailhouse Rock?
It's such a great song. It's a story. You know, his voice comes in for a start. And it's just going through a can.
Yeah,
and you're just like, whoa, it just makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. But then the actual story's going on and, you know, you're there. He's telling you the characters' names and what they're doing and they're dancing. And you go through this whole thing. And it was only years later I found that is Lieber and Stoller. That is like the top of the tree of American storytelling.
Come here, imagine if you were a kid when it came out first, like,
and
you heard this. Okay, here it is, Elvis Presley, Jailhouse Rock. Elvis Presley, Jailhouse Rock, and that is Coyta Reardon's first music choice. You're right, like, he paints the whole picture, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
So as you grew up then and went to school and as people start discovering music, their own music then, was music your thing? Like, were you one of those kids?
Yeah, really, really always, as I remember it, just from that beginning, from like my dad being a major music fan and then really wanting to be a rock and roller. Like, remember being 11 and like really, really wanting a Teddy Boy outfit. And like, for some reason, I had like a Bill Haley double album that I knew inside out. That's really why. Yeah, I was a rocker. And then when I was 13, they gave me a little transistor radio. Really, it was the size of your hand back then. And that was kind of the end of it. I would literally stay up till 2 in the morning, just like turning the dial, finding all the stations. You know, listening to them talking in French and what, you know, not even knowing what the languages were I was hearing. And then a track would come on. And BBC, obviously, I grew up out near Heathrow Airport, and BBC, the kind of afternoon shows on Radio 2 were like hugely educational. There was like guys just casually throwing in jazz records in between all the oldies. Like, I knew 40s, 50s, 60s music. And it was the 70s, but of course it was recent history then.
That's it, of course.
It would be like listening to 90s music
Yeah,
now.
I know, it's gas, isn't it? You left home when you were very young then.
Yeah, had to get out and just always had that bug, you know, just on a completely different time zone to everyone around me. And school was really hard because I just wasn't awake in the morning, but you had to be there. And so yeah, got out and got in the hostel system pretty quickly. You know, I was on the streets for a while, but there were safety nets back then. It was kind of the last vestiges of the safety nets. Obviously, the full Thatcher thing just started happening a year or two before I left home, and I think she was on the record at that point of saying there's no such thing as society. And all the kind of safety nets for runaways and vulnerable people were being dismantled, but I caught the last of it. So I was
Really,
in.
so you there was a system there to kind of look
There
after you,
was
yeah?
there was hostels, and you know, you hear terrible things, but obviously I was lucky. I was in safe places, and there was fully funded social workers who actually wanted to kind of help you and get you in job schemes and get you working and earning.
And how did you end up picking up the bass then? Was it punk came along or?
One of the programs, the social programs I was talking about, was called the Youth Opportunities Program, and it was, you know, a serious London government program that was supposed to get you into jobs. But the crowd I fell in with were this very alternative, living in squats up in the back of Notting Hill Gate, not the posh Notting Hill, but the back end of it under the Westway, and they started an alternative scheme. I'm doing the air quotes here, listeners, called the Yob scheme, which was, yeah, I don't know if you say Yob in Ireland, but it just meant like yeah, guria. And it was hilarious. And they had instruments lying around, like people would donate things to them, and you could just go into this big kind of shed, the back of the Westway, and pick something up. And I loved the bass because it was heavy. And it was only 4 strings, and like I tried 6-string guitar, but it felt really spindly, and like couldn't get my fingers around it. And you pick up a bass, and as soon as you start hammering those eighth notes, you're making a noise and you're playing a song, you know. And it's just like instant gratification, and I just loved that low end sound. And it's like, oh, I'm a bass player, cool.
And like you are kind of the ultimate bass player. People couldn't imagine you doing anything else. Like you and the bass are kind of one at this stage almost, aren't you?
Dude, stop.
I did the most one of the most rock and roll things I ever saw was, remember Gavin Friday did a few gigs, kind of one-offs. I remember at the end of it you were playing in the band. You did Daddy Cool by Boney M, and you had the bass line going and you were doing the backing vocals as well, and for some reason it stayed in my head as like it was incredibly rock and
Because it
roll.
was, Gavin Friday, what an artist. He should do some more gigs.
Your next choice is the Pretenders.
Ah, yeah, man. I Top of the Pops, for the young people that don't know, it was on once a week, And it was only half an hour on the telly. And this was before the internet. If you wanted to hear something, you either had to keep the radio on all day and try and tape a song if you liked it, or hope it would get in the top 40. And then the artist would go on Top of the Pops. And then sometimes they'd throw you a curveball and you'd see something you'd never seen before. And I distinctly remember in 1979, this band came on. Four people, one of them was a woman, she's playing guitar, and then she steps up to the mic and she starts singing this song, Kid. And it was so beautiful. The whole, every element of it, how cool the whole band looked, how cool she looked, how great her voice was. And then again, this story song, it wasn't Lieber and Stoller kind of storytelling, it was just a vignette, a huge empathic lyric about wanting to understand why a child is sad. And I was like, oh man, and it just kind of went, even thinking about it now, it's goosebumpy. And I just imprinted on her like an orphaned gosling. Yeah. I was like, there's my mum, that's my mum or my big sister. And yeah, got the fringe, got the eyeliner. There were other girls at school, it had the same effect on. I remember one of the rich kids at school, Sheena McDonald, I remember her name. She showed up in a red leather jacket, exactly like Chrissy's wearing on the front cover of the Pretenders' first album. That was like, I would kill her for that.
Okay, here's Carter Rodden's second choice, the Pretenders' Kid. So that's the Pretenders and Kid, and that's Carter Reardon's second choice today. So do you remember then in all of this when you first met Shane McGowan?
Oh yeah, very clearly. I used to, after school, I'd go and I'd get on a bus and then get on a tube and go into London to go to these record stores that I'd hear about on the pirate radio stations I was listening to. Like, they'd always name check radio stations that were sponsoring them. So I'd go and find them and just see what's the story here. And I ended up at one in Camden called Rock On, which was run by a couple of legends, Ted Carroll. And everyone knew Ted. He was connected to Thin Lizzy and Frank Murray, who ended up managing the Pogues. Yeah. He was kind of like the central figure in this kind of Irish music in London scene. And they had a spin-off shop, and it was called Rocks Off, Rock On and Rocks Off, that was run by two fellas from the north, from Belfast, Stan Brennan and Phil Gaston. And so I went to check out their store and they were really cool. And they said, we're going for a drink after, we're closing up, we're going for a drink, come round to the pub. And I was like, oh yeah. So how old was I? But I was big anyway, I was a very tall kid. So I went round there and they said, Shane's coming, Shane works with us. And their friend Shane walks in and I recognise him because I've been reading the music press at this stage, been reading the NME and whatever for a couple of years. And it's Shane McGowan. I'm like, oh, you're Shane McGowan from the Nips.
Yeah.
And you're Shane McGowan. He goes, am I? And it was the most perfect punk rock thing. And I was like, this is so cool. I'm sitting in a pub in London and this big punk is sneering at me. Yes.
And then how did you end up joining a band with him?
Oh, man. I was too young to go to his first gig. He'd got this little band together and he said, we're playing a gig, but I was too young to go. And but I met him the next day on Oxford Street and I just got my dole money. It wasn't dole because I wasn't old enough for the dole. It was called supplementary benefit, and because I was living in hostels, and I had the supplementary benefit money in my pocket. And I said, how was your gig? And he's going, oh, it was all right. We're too quiet, though. We need to add, like, electric bass. And he goes, you're a bass player, because I told him about the Yob scheme. And I was like, okay, I'll be the bass player. And then he was like, you got any money? Yeah. So he says, all right. And he points over the road, and the Hog in the Pound pub is over the road. So we go in there, and I think I had to buy him a whiskey. And that was the price of joining his
price
band.
Of entry, yeah.
That was that.
Yeah, well worth paying.
It was worth a whiskey. Yeah, sure, the money was burning a hole in my pocket, all like 19 quid.
And so those early days, were they as wild and crazy as it seems?
I think they were. I think they were, yeah. Up to, I think more like our supporters were wild and crazy, because the thing, thinking back amazingly to the actual band, I was the only weak link, really. Everyone else was kind of focused, obviously. Like, Shane had this thing he needed to express. He was, you know, a creative artist, and the other musicians were serious musicians. Spider was a bit of a messer, and he was still in the banging himself on the head with the tin tray at that point. And so there was a focus to the work, but then when we get to the gigs, we had this powerful effect on people.
Yeah.
And they'd get very messy, so I'd get very messy. And so it was a bit of a contagion, but the lads were working, you know, and they were really good at it.
You couldn't have made that music if there wasn't work being done on some
level.
Thank
you, Brendan. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't an accident.
Yeah. Your next choice is a bit of early U2.
Yes.
So when did you start to become aware of them? Would you have known them, like?
1980. And I know now that the reason we started hearing them on kind of the BBC radio and the London radio stations, because they'd signed an international deal with Island Records that year. And only found out later they'd had this whole 1979 CBS record, but we started hearing them on the radio, and I remember hearing 11 o'clock TikTok, and it kind of having very spooky and interesting. I think, well, that's great, but I was also buying singles by The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen, and the first time I heard U2, I wasn't quite ready to go and buy the single, but then the second song I heard was A Day Without Me. And at the time, there was a rumour that it had been written about Ian Curtis, who had died a few months before and had been very traumatic on people. People were very, very upset about Ian Curtis. Mm. And kind of hearing the U2 song in that context, it made a huge impression. And then kind of the next day, I was like, skipped lunch and went and bought the single. And that started my U2 collection. I've loved everything they've done since then.
Okay, here's you two, A Day Without Me. Okay, that's you two, A Day Without Me. That's Kyger Reardon's third choice. Kyger, your next song is a song people very much associate with you. You sang it on Rum Sodomy and the Lash.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day. So this is it's an old folk song, is it?
Yeah, it's very old, hundreds of years old. And there's you can tell how old it is because there's so many different versions where the words are slightly different. But I mentioned a radio shop, a record shop I used to hang around with, Shane McGowan worked, called Rocks Off. And one of the guys in charge there, Phil Gaston, one day he just picked up this album and said, you'd enjoy this. And he played a few tracks off it. And it was just, it was the same as like seeing Chrissie Hynde for the first time, hearing Jeannie Robertson for the first time, who was a traveller lady from Aberdeen. And her voice, again, it was just, it really just went straight into my DNA, and I just recognised it. And it made a huge impression on me. And Phil gave me the album. And I knew all the songs by heart, and I'd sing them for Shane because we used to swap songs, you know, in that kind of folky way. And he really loved I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day. And then when we came time to make our second album, we made Red Roses for me, and then we went in to make Rum Sodomy and the Lash. And Shane said, I want to put that on the album. You have to sing it and put it on the album. I was like, okay. yeah, we did. And it's amazing, the power of that song. It means a lot to people.
Okay, here's Jeannie Robertson's version of I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day.
For my name is Jock Stewart. I'm a canny gunman, but a roving young fella I have been. So be easy and free when you're drinking with me. I'm a man you don't meet every day. Come fill up your glasses of brandy and wine. Whatever it costs, I will pay. So be easy and free when you're drinking with me. I'm a man you don't meet every day.
Oh. No, that stopped you in your tracks, didn't it? That's Jeannie Robertson, I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day. That's Carter Reardon's fourth choice. You sang that song at Shane's amazing funeral. Was it hard?
It was hard. It was, only afterwards I realised how focused I was on just like getting through it. And it was all like, you know, you have to do this then and you have to go here. So it was like, get through it. And Shane's there. Yeah. And it was a bit, it was very strange to do it, but it needed to be done. And then once it was done, I went and sat back down by the choir and I just went and hid behind the choir and had a cry, because then it was all like, you could just let it hit you. And Imelda was there. Imelda May was right there, and she saw me, and she came over and gave me a hug. So it was good. So I kind of get it out and then pull myself together again for the rest of the service. So it was hard, but it meant a huge amount to people. I had people all over the world telling me they watched the whole thing.
It became this kind of viral thing where people started saying to each other, are you watching this? This is incredible. And suddenly it grew over the course of the afternoon.
Yeah.
Has it been hard for you, Shane's death? Did it hit you hard?
Yeah, very hard. And because I think he was genuinely like the most important person in my life. Like everything that's great in my life now kind of comes from that day on Oxford Street, and Shane saying, be in my band. and everything that happens, everyone that I know loves the Pogues, and all the gigs I get, the reference is always the Pogues. And then for Shane to be gone, and like young as well. And in a year, we lost Christy, then we lost Sinead. And then Shane go, and you're like, what is happening? What is happening? It was a tough few months. We had a kind of a cathartic thing at Carnegie Hall a few weeks ago, where we had a big tribute, combined tribute to Shane and Sinead. So I feel like that was kind of the end of the initial kind of grieving denial process and kind of going through that at Carnegie Hall's kind of moved me into the acceptance phase, but it's so sad.
Yeah. What was your relationship with them like?
It was great. It was like pretty rambunctious. We, you know, we'd get into big fights and then we'd totally like get over it and pick a song to sing, and you know, we'd fight on stage, but then a lot of the time I just remember like listening in awe, like Shane McGowan and Spider Stacy talking about literature or history or politics was like the most fantastic education, like these very highly educated autodidact, I think, in Spider's case. Shane went to some incredible posh fancy school via his dad's job, and they knew everything. They were very funny, incredibly cultured, but in a punk way. Like they got into a fight about Taoist poetry,
yeah,
which ended with Shane standing up in fury, jabbing his finger at Spider, goes, "Don't take the piss out of Taoist poetry, right?" I just thought, this is the greatest school in the world.
Yeah. So many people kind of said around the time of his death that the Shane that was kind of projected to the world and the easy notion people had about him, there was a far more complex reality there.
Deeply complex. I spent years saying to people, Shane is one of the great Irish poets of the 20th century. And they were like staring at me like, yeah, what are you on? But at some point it broke through and people got it. And I think maybe when we had the big party for him at the National Concert Hall for his 60th.
Which was an extraordinary
event. Anouk Theron came out and gave him like a Lifetime Achievement Award. That seemed to be a turning point.
Yeah. Did he appreciate that night as well? He did.
Of course, yeah. He loved it. He loved it very much. It meant the world to him. Any time that people would step up for him,
yeah,
it was very important. And the fact that it was just a big celebration of him, and everyone was just loving it. That was a mad night as well. You never hear from so many people you haven't heard from in years as when you're booked to play a big fancy gig like that, and suddenly your DMs are just, "Hey, Coach, I hear you're playing a gig."
Yeah. And they did all step up from Bono was there, Nick Cave. Sinead kind of came out of hiding and remember just
Sinead, do you remember her walking out just on her own, unintroduced? And the place, the roar when people saw it's Sinead, and the love. And I remember how kind of surprised she looked. That's what always got me. You could tell she was on that cycle that a lot of us get into. Like you'd give her love and she'd take it and then she'd forget that the world was full of love. And she'd go down the cycle into the dark again. And then she'd come back round again until she couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. But Shane too knew he was loved and appreciated in those.
He got the message.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, your last choice is Lucinda Williams, Change the Locks. We don't really have a huge amount of time to talk about it because I want to ask you, what are you up to musically these days?
Well, I'm based out in New York at the moment, and I have a residency at the Irish Arts Centre in Manhattan with Paul Muldoon, the poet. I'm in his band there for his regular gigs, but he's brought the band, who are all American except me and Paul, over to Ireland. We're going to do a few gigs here.
So this is Muldoon's Picnic.
Irish Picnic.
Okay, Muldoon's Irish Picnic. So yeah, there are four dates nationwide from the 13th to the 17th of May. And for more information and ticket prices, people can go to poetryireland.ie. And actually, it does feel like when you say New York now, it feels like I've got a downtown New York hipster from the 70s in front of
it
me there.
It feels like
as close
home
as I'm ever going to get. I can imagine. I'd say you fit right in there.
I do.
Yeah. Okay, we'll finish up with Lucinda Williams and Change the Locks. Coisha Reardon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brendan. I changed the number on my phone.
trending at rte.ie.